From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Mary McIntyre, Intersection's producer, and I'll be your host this week. Podcasting and audio production are having a great moment right now, and lots of people want to learn how to make great audio. Transom is an organization that teaches radio production both online and through traveling workshops across the country. The Missouri Audio Project and the University of Missouri hosted a Transom traveling workshop this summer. I attended the workshop with 8 students and 2 teachers for 1 week, and each of us produced a radio story. Rob Rosenthal is a radio producer who teaches for Transom. Can you tell me a little bit about the workshop, kind of what that week looks like?
It's hectic. It's actually exhausting. I think people leave and the first thing they do is go to sleep because we've worked them so hard. And also they leave exhilarated because they've produced a radio story in the course of a week. And that's primarily what the workshop's about. Students come in, most of them have had no experience, or maybe they've had just, you know, a little bit of experience. They're dabbling and maybe they've gone so far as to produce a story or two for a radio station. But I think broadly you could categorize them as beginners. And our task in the workshop is for them to produce what we hope will be a broadcast quality, first time out of the gate radio story. And we take them through all of the steps. Yeah, even before the workshop begins, we're talking about how to find a story. And then during the workshop, we're teaching students how to interview, how to use their recording equipment, how to gather sound, what is a story, you know, defining what story is, writing for radio, voicing for radio, mixing and editing, ethics. Like, we're covering the gamut. The days are long, but in the end, the students leave with what I hope is a good understanding of the best practices for producing a radio story, as well as a system for repeating this so that when they leave the workshop, they can go do it again.
And if you could choose, I mean, there are lots of things that you're learning throughout the workshop as a student, but if you could choose one main takeaway that you want students to leave with, what would that be?
They can do this. I think for most people, radio is a bit of a mystery. How the heck does that get made? I mean, it sounds kind of flawless when you turn on the radio and you hear these stories. They don't have a lot of problems in them. They're so well produced and written and delivered and so on. But how does it get made? And I want to make sure people leave feeling like they can make radio stories afterward. If I had something sort of other than inspiration, you know, something curricular to say, I want them to know how to tell a good story. What makes for a good story? Something that people are going to want to listen to.
Liza Lichtenfeld is a medical student in North Carolina. She traveled all the way to Missouri for the workshop. What was probably the most challenging part of the workshop for you?
I mean, the week was just really fun. I've spent the last 4 years in medical school, and we have really long days, but these were long days where you felt tangibly like you were building something. You know, you started out day one with just a microphone and a certain degree of incompetence, and by the end of the week, we're teasing apart levels. And that's a really dramatic shift and satisfying in a way that a lot of projects often aren't, or a lot of classes often aren't. The other thing is just, it was so refreshing to be with this group of people. You know, we had a wide age range. I was somewhere in the middle. And just, you know, half of our class, I think about, was including you, were younger journalism students and just really impressive, hungry, talented people. It's always an inspiring thing to work with people like that, no matter what you're doing. I think the hardest thing for me during that week was definitely the sort of technical aspect and just feeling confident that I wasn't going to screw up that piece of it. And I also just got way too much tape, so I was wrestling with that bit as well.
What was the most rewarding part of the week for you?
Radio has always been this medium that I'm drawn to. I have a background in writing fiction and telling stories. You know, I think that the one thing that was sort of surprising about the week was that, like, how much of what you learn in medical school is sort of tangentially relevant. So talking to people, how to interview people, those sorts of bedside manner, I guess, is sort of relevant when you're speaking to subjects as well. But sort of unpacking or demystifying this thing that for me always felt sort of inaccessible, and making it all of a sudden like, oh, I can do this. I can do this thing. It takes a lot of time. Sometimes it's really tedious, but maybe I can do this thing.
After this workshop, were you inspired to keep making radio?
Yeah, totally. I think you can attest to this, but I acted like a total maniac. And, have been back to Missouri, you know, trying to follow up on this other story. And I'm working on smaller things in North Carolina and, you know, still doing medical school. So trying to figure out a way to fold in this one new passion into, you know, what I'm going to do with my life.
Can you tell me a little bit about your story?
Sure. It's about a story of a middle-aged man negotiating a serious diagnosis of mental illness, you know, holding on to his creative aspirations.
Here's an excerpt from Liza's story on Stephen Wright.
Can you tell me your first and last name?
Stephen Wright.
Can you tell me about your diagnosis?
I have bipolar disorder. I was diagnosed in 2007. Bipolar itself is a combination of manic episodes and depressive episodes occurring at random in your lifetime.
Have you stayed in a psychiatric hospital before?
Yes. I have been on one psychiatric hold, and I've had one voluntary admission.
How did you end up there?
I had gone to the hospital, the ER, in a manic state where everything was racing. Everything was racing. I couldn't control myself. I couldn't control my thoughts, I should say. And the ER physician on duty took the initiative to make it a mandatory 72-hour hold.
Did you consider contesting that?
No, I did not. I accepted it.
We say strange things about mental illness. The way we talk about losing your mind as if it's a pair of underwear you could leave behind at the laundromat. I think about what it's like to lose that grip, that footing, to linger too long on the edges of human perception. I keep asking Stephen questions.
So tell me what that looked like, depression looked like.
When you're manic, how does it feel like time's moving?
What happened?
Compared to how time's moving in your head.
What do you think about that?
When's the first time you remember?
What was the undoing?
I like talking to Stephen. He has a kind face. At 46, he looks older than his age, though the baldness doesn't help. We talk for too long because I can't seem to make sense of the math. He had the wife, the kids, some years of college, numerous jobs, for numerous years.
When did things
fell apart? There was some alcohol somewhere, and then some benzos and marijuana. But these are not satisfactory explanations. I ask him, what's the craziest thing he's ever done? He tells me he bought a house. I ask him about the second craziest thing. He says he bought a car. Purchasing a house and a car that you can't really afford, that just seems American. I heard about a guy who did this once. Red walls, red refrigerator, red television, everything red. I keep asking questions because I can't find the logic. I ask him about the worst thing he's ever done.
I hopped on a ferry. It was an evening ferry. It was dark. I think it was 8 o'clock ferry. And I went to the back loading dock, and I jumped off into Puget Sound into very cold water. I was hoping the hypothermia would take me quickly, and it would be done.
In those first seconds when you were underwater, what did you think about?
There was silence. It was just plain silence. My mind was quiet.
Do you think that's the goal?
That is the goal, yeah. I mean, that's the goal, to be in control of any mental illness, I believe. Is to have that silence from, for me, from the bipolar, so I can live.
So you felt silence when you were underwater. How did you feel when you came back up, when you were rescued?
Chaos.
I found a lot of things on Craigslist, including, but not limited to, my last roommate, my current house, several couches, a regrettable coffee table, a stereo. Last week I found this ad.
It reads, "The next Jared Kerouac / Truman Capote needs your help. I have years of collected journals and stories I am weaving into the greatest fiction / nonfiction work of the 21st century. I need a typewriter, paper, correction tape, and funding because my disability leaves me with no extra money. I get to the library once or twice a week to check my email. I will respond, and any assistance is appreciated."
This is Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM. We're talking with people who participated in a radio workshop in Columbia this summer. We're learning about the stories they found and why they care about working in radio. Shane Epping is a professional photographer. What has the workshop done for you as far as wanting to continue to tell stories?
I think it's inspired me in two ways. One would be in the classroom. I teach a course in the School of Journalism, and I've always seen that class as an opportunity for students to engage with storytelling, maybe in a way that they haven't in the past, and that's by central compelling character type narratives. So that's one way that it's inspired me, is to dig a little deeper in finding examples and even personal experiences that I've had in trying to do this kind of stuff and sharing that with the students. The other way would be in my job as a photographer. We also, my department, Mizzou Creative, started a podcast called Eureka. And we've only, I think, had a couple chapters. We might be on the third one right now. It's kind of research-based, but, you know, research is a broad topic. And I think it's pushed me to really emphasize to the team I work with the importance of central compelling characters and in narrative, and how that can really be the core, the backbone of whatever message it is that we want to deliver.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. People connect with people. So that's a really good takeaway.
I think that, you know, going into the workshop, I knew it was going to be challenging and some late nights. And the veterans from last year had kind of warned me about that. And I think what I would say about it, it reminds me a lot of a photo equivalent that happens here in Missouri, the Missouri Photo Workshop. And sometimes the end product isn't necessarily the justification for doing these workshops. It's really sitting down with an interesting set of participants. Like, I think there were 9 of us, right?
Yeah.
We were all kind of different, but passionate, and we wanted to tell stories. And so I think that was kind of my takeaway, is that there were all kinds of people with diverse interests who wanted to participate. And while I don't think any of us were maybe 100% satisfied with what we made in the 5 days that we were together, it was the experience that really justified it more so than the final product. And that's a real testament to education and learning.
Here's an excerpt from Shane's story on Michael Byrne and his wife, Rigel, as they face a tragic diagnosis.
When Rigel Oliveri's best friend was diagnosed with cancer, Rigel refused to acknowledge the possibility that her friend might die.
You know, she'd say, "I'm really scared," or, "Will you promise me you'll do X, Y, and Z with my things when I die, and I'd say, you're not going to die. You're going to be fine. It's going to be okay. Don't talk like that. And I just wouldn't let her vocalize it. And she must have felt very alone.
After only 11 months, her friend died from stage 4 melanoma, and Rigel made a pledge to never make the same mistake again.
If anybody close to me is ever sick or having anything like this, I will be there with them. And then it was just my really bad luck that it was Michael.
Rigel is crying for her husband, Michael. Michael and Rigel have been married for 9 years, and they have two kids.
The first night we met, I fell in love with her. She was so smart and so funny, and she looked really hot, which helped.
It was like a romantic comedy. Rigel knew a lot about Michael because she knew his sister and some of his friends. He was from New Zealand. He was going to Harvard Law School. He was interning at a fancy litigation firm. He had a girlfriend. Michael, on the other hand, knew nothing about Rigel, except that she was hot.
And I thought you were good looking. I was like, too bad he's got a girlfriend. But then you came over and we started talking, or I came over and started talking to you. We had this great conversation, and I started to get kind of mad at him because I was like, this is unacceptable that you have a girlfriend and you are here with me having this, you know, interaction. But I basically...
It should be noted, I did not have a girlfriend.
You did not have a girlfriend.
I'd broken up with my girlfriend.
Rigel had received some bad intel.
I was very mean to him. I basically sat there and said, oh, wow, you're a lawyer? Oh, I bet that's really hard. Wow, you're studying for the New York bar. That must be really, really hard. And I kind of let him talk about himself. And then right at the end of the conversation...
No. Like, you can't get to the punchline. She didn't just say, oh, it must be really hard. She also led me down the primrose path with lots of questions such as, oh, so where'd you go to law school? And I think when I said Boston, she said, when you said Boston, did you mean Harvard? And I was like, yeah. I've heard that a lot of people who go to Harvard like are a bunch of assholes. Has that been your experience? Are there a bunch of assholes at Harvard?
They went on like this for a while.
And so finally, when the conversation was just sort of about done.
About done for her.
I was like, oh, I'm a lawyer for the Justice Department. I also took the New York bar. I thought it was pretty easy. I graduated from Stanford. We're ranked number 2 now. Harvard's number 3. It's been nice talking to you. And then I just walked away.
I was crushed. I was completely crushed. And then I couldn't get her out of my head.
Not too long afterwards, they went on their first date, and the rest, as they say, is history. Life was good. They were happy. But like everybody, they were busy and probably taking a lot for granted. The everyday drudgery included little fights about Michael not finishing his dinner that Rigel had made for him, or Michael complaining that he was too tired to give the kids a bath. But how was she to know that some of her frustrations with Michael really weren't his fault? In February of 2016, Michael was diagnosed with stage 3 esophageal cancer. It's notoriously difficult to treat, and Michael's odds do not look good. Only 5% of those diagnosed with this type of cancer will beat it. He might live 5 more years, or he might live 1 more year. The worst case scenario was 6 months. He's participating in a clinical chemotherapy trial that he hopes will extend his time with his family. He's 43 years old.
If I was a betting man, I'd bet against me. Like, I have no illusion that this is what is going to kill me. My hope is that it kills me later than earlier.
Rigel learned the reality of cancer from her best friend who died from melanoma. She knew what they were in for. These thoughts kept her awake on the night that Michael was diagnosed.
So I got up. I just couldn't sleep and couldn't deal with it. And I came downstairs and I looked up this information and it was horrible. And I was kind of running around in the house having a panic attack. I was kind of breathing, couldn't really breathe. And I finally was like, I have to get out. And so I just went, I put on shoes and a coat and just went outside. And I don't know how many miles I walked, but I walked all through the neighborhood. I went down onto the trail. This was early February. So it was really cold and really dark outside because it was probably by then about 3:30 in the morning. And I just was crying. I was just kind of walking and crying.
Rigel wasn't giving up. She knew Michael would fight like hell. But she also had been down this road before, and she knew that it was going to be brutal.
It's kind of like, you know, you buy a lottery ticket, and of course you hope that you're going to win. And of course you also know you're not going to win. The statistics are ridiculous. But instead of finding out, oh, I didn't win, you know, $1 million, you find out you're going to die. And you have to play that lottery every week.
To continually expect good news from the doctor, but receive the opposite again and again and again, is demoralizing. It's like being in a fight, and as Rigel says, getting sucker punched in the face, round after round. Sooner or later, you've got to protect yourself from the beating if you want to keep fighting. For Rigel, that means accepting Michael's fate. She has to keep going. There are bills to pay, kids to care for, a career as a law school professor, and limited time with Michael.
She has shouldered way more of the burden of all of this than I would ever expect anybody to have to shoulder. And the strength that she has shown makes me very, very glad that I chose her for my wife. I was actually just teasing her yesterday about that if I was going to give advice to Griffin, my son, when looking for a future spouse, or for Shani for that matter, thinking about, will this person take care of me when I'm dying, is a pretty good actual indicator.
We all know that we're going to die, but most of us don't know when it'll happen, and we don't know when it'll happen to our loved ones. But what if we did? Would we ignore the statistics and tell ourselves that everything is going to be okay to make ourselves feel better? Or would we be there for our loved one, really be there, to help him not feel alone, even if everything isn't going to be okay?
A year from now, we'll all be gone. All our friends will move away, and they're going to bed.
We're always very good at talking to each other. We entertain each other very well. But I know how much you know how much I appreciate everything you've done. And I'm just so glad. I don't know if I could make this through what I have to do without Rigel's support. And it's just been there unwavering, and it's just been phenomenal. It really has.
But I miss your face.
I'm Shane Epping for the Missouri Audio Project.
This is Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM. Christopher Saunders is a farmer and aspiring radio producer living in Shelby County.
Because I was already attempting to do radio, and this really gave me the process to complete other stories that I had been working on. It was pretty important just to finish a piece because I didn't work in a newsroom or didn't have the option to go to school or go to classes because I needed to work, I need to make money because I have a family. So that wasn't really an option to go to a university or go to any other resource. Transom was really the only way I could ever have access to quality education from talented people.
Here's an excerpt from Christopher's story about a World War II veteran who was a prisoner of war.
I kind of hid in a tree when I got down while this no farmer had no rifle there pointing out at me.
On September 12, 1944, Robert Vickers was flying over Nazi Germany.
As soon as we got out of the edge of the woods, well, there's women and kids and people all around. They'd run up and beat on you and hammer on you. And he'd hit me with a butt and knock me down. And they run out with dishwater and rotten tomatoes and anything they had in the kitchen to come out and throw on you.
4 years earlier, Robert was on a different farm, growing up in the tiny rural town of Clarence, Missouri. In 1941, he left behind his high school sweetheart, Helen Peterson, and enrolled at the University of Missouri. His plan was to study agriculture and return to Clarence to farm, but just after finals, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
I knew I had to be getting in something if I had any choice of my own.
He immediately enlisted in the Air Force. Back in Clarence, he proposed to Helen. The wedding was set for January, but the Air Force called and told him he had a week to get to Santa Ana. Robert went through pre-flight school. He got his wings, became a second lieutenant. His post was half navigation, half bombardier.
And since I had both of them, they kind of had another name for it. It was a bombigator.
His squadron was shipped to England. They began flying over Germany, bombing factories. After 27 missions, he received orders to bomb a target 30 miles north of Berlin. He only had two more missions to fly after that one, and then he'd be going home. As they approached their target, German fighter planes appeared on the horizon and pummeled them with machine gun fire. Robert's plane caught fire. His crew opened the hatch and one by one leapt from the burning plane. The sky was filled with debris.
Oh, there'd be a burning wing go off on the side and air was just full of chaff. It was like Christmas tree decoration icicles. Well, when the airplane blew up, that stuff was in the air just thick. Well, all the far as you could see, it was just tinkling in the sun.
Thanks for joining Intersection while we talk to people who took the Transom Traveling Radio Workshop in Columbia this summer. You can listen to the full versions of the stories featured on today's show, as well as all the other stories produced during the workshop at MissouriAudioProject.com. To thank our producers Sarah Shariari, Molly Olmsted, Sophia Zhang, Daniel Hogarty, and Rachel Foster Gimble. And thank you to Rob Rosenthal from Transom and Yulia Shakis from the Missouri Audio Project.